From the JAMA Network, this is JAMA Clinical Reviews, interviews and ideas about innovations in medicine, science, and clinical practice. Here's your host, Ed Livingston.
You might have heard of the Pritikin diet, but you probably don't know what it is or what it's for. It's an ultra-low-fat, low-salt diet that was originally intended to lower cholesterol to treat cardiovascular disease in an era when there were no effective treatments for either clinical problem. In its day, it was a major breakthrough. It's interesting to learn about it, if for no other reason, to review the extremely limited knowledge about important diseases that existed in the 1950s and how much progress we've made since that time. Most likely, you don't know who Pritikin was. It's worth finding out. Being a bariatric surgeon, I knew of the diet, and I had thought Pritikin was a physician, but he wasn't. In fact, he has more in common with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates than any doctor.
When I entered University of Chicago, towards the end of my second year, even though I had a scholarship from the university, which helped me, of course, with tuition, I had to give up before the second year ended because I couldn't raise the $5 a week for room and board by the end of the second year.
Nathan dropped out of college.
I decided then to go into research and development. Research and development is a very polite term. That means that if you succeed at a project that you take for a company, they'll pay you. If you don't succeed, you do it on your own. So in effect, no one paid me for anything unless I succeeded. But it took me a couple of years before I learned how to do research projects to be successful.
Like Jobs and Gates, Nathan dropped out of college and developed his own company, one based on his idea steeped in research. This was in the mid-1930s, in the middle of the Depression. There was never a harder time to try to make it on your own. But Nathan did. But while he was getting himself established, World War II came around, and he got work from the government that gave him access to otherwise secret information.
I was very interested in certain parts of the secret information the Air Force had to offer. And that was in the death rates and the disease rates in the food ration countries in Europe. I was so certain that the death rates were going to rise so considerably because I was told then, and many people believed and still believe today, that stress is the principal reason for heart disease. And so I was looking for the deaths from heart disease to double because the stress was terrible in those food ration countries in Europe, England, France, Holland, and so on.
Back then, stress was thought to be the root of many diseases that were common in that era: heart attacks, stroke, peptic ulcer disease, and others. Pritikin devised a sort of natural experiment by looking at cardiac events and deaths in war-stressed populations.
It was really a very terrible war. The population never knew when their children would come home alive from school. A lot of stress. And yet, 1944, in one of the most stressful years of the war, death rates from heart disease dropped to one-half of pre-war levels. It was astounding. And it was that way in all the countries under food rationing. In countries not under food rationing, like the United States, death rates from heart disease continued to rise and never showed a drop. And when the war was just starting to be over and the concentration camps were opened up by our soldiers, it was amazing to find that those who had been in concentration camps for the full 4 years, who had been diagnosed by the German doctors, who incidentally were very thorough, even though they were very cruel perhaps, they were very thorough in diagnosing diseases. Those who had heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, 4 years after that kind of tremendous stress, they had none of these diseases.
This was a very important observation that's relevant today. More than 75 years ago, Pritikin noticed that the prevailing hypothesis of the day, that stress caused heart attacks, was wrong, and was proven wrong in the most extreme of conditions. Cardiovascular disease was rare amongst patients living in some of the most dreadful war zones that have ever been created. These people were starving because of food rationing. Other populations, who had an abundance of food, like the United States, continued to have rising rates of cardiovascular disease. The degree of cardiovascular disease was strictly a function of food availability. This gave Pritikin the idea that cardiovascular disease could be controlled by diet, a somewhat novel idea at the time. When the food came back, so did the cardiovascular disease.
Well, it wasn't long after the war when I began to realize what the true story was, because when the food rationing was lifted, it only took a year or two after food rationing was lifted for death rates to rise and exceed pre-war levels. In fact, in Austria in 1957, there were 700% more deaths from heart disease than in Austria in 1944 when Hitler was walking all over the country.
Pritikin came across the work of Lester M. Morrison, a physician investigator working at the L.A. County Hospital, who was on the faculty of the College of Medical Evangelists, which eventually became Loma Linda University. Writing in the December 10, 1955 issue of JAMA, Dr. Morrison reviewed evidence from World War I demonstrating that in Britain, during the German blockade that resulted in severe food shortages, the number of deaths attributable to coronary and cerebrovascular disease fell. Those death rates from vascular disease rose back to the original level after the war when food availability was restored. The same thing happened in the Scandinavian countries during World War II, where food was very scarce during the war, and that scarcity resulted in a lowering of death rates from vascular disease, which then snapped back once food became available again after the war. Based on these observations, Dr. Morrison embarked on a study where he took 50 patients who'd had myocardial infarctions and placed them on a very low-fat diet, less than 25 grams of fat a day, with less than about 75 milligrams of cholesterol. And he compared them to 50 control patients who had no dietary intervention. These patients were followed over many years, and there were several publications in JAMA reporting the results from this cohort. The 12-year follow-up was published in the June 25, 1960 issue of JAMA, showing that 19 of the original 50 patients who received the low-fat diet were alive at 12 years, and none of the 50 patients who had the restricted diet survived. Pritikin went to Los Angeles to meet with Morrison. Morrison measured Pritikin's serum cholesterol, finding it to be about 300, which in those days was considered high normal. A couple of years later, he went to the Samsung Clinic in Santa Barbara and had a cardiac stress test that showed coronary insufficiency. This was in 1957, and in those days there were no drugs to reduce cholesterol, and coronary artery disease was treated with severe activity limitation. Those were the days before bypass operations.
I went to Dr. Clay Keg, and he said, "You have coronary insufficiency." He said, "You have posterior wall myocardial ischemia." He said, "And you have to immediately stop all activity." I said, "All activity?" He says, "You cannot walk upstairs anymore. You've got to nap every day after lunch. And you've got to limit your walking to no more than about 4 or 5 blocks a day for the entire day." He said, "And if you're going to drive your car more than 100 feet away from where you're going to go, have someone else park it for you." I said, "I can't be that sick. I don't seem to have any symptoms. I don't feel anything." He says, "You better do as I tell you, or you're going to find yourself on the sidewalk laying down one day, and you won't get up." And he started me off on a medication. Well, the medication made my pupils open up. I had to wear sunglasses in the daytime, and it made me worse. So I did that for a month, and I finally decided that wasn't going to work for me. I stopped taking medication.
That's the way it was in the 1950s. There was no good way to lower cholesterol, and the treatment for coronary artery disease was to avoid activity. Pritikin wasn't the type of person to take no for an answer, so he went to UCLA.
Well, they said, "You can't lower your cholesterol level by diet, because first you'd have to cut out some of the foods high in cholesterol, and they're the best foods that the body must have. They're the eggs, they're the cheeses, and so on." He says, "You've got to have those foods." And I said, "Well, the animal studies tell me that if you delete these foods high in cholesterol, your cholesterol level will drop." He said, "First of all, it wouldn't make any difference. What you eat doesn't determine your cholesterol. That's determined by hereditary reasons. And if you want to lower your cholesterol that way, we can't help you. It'd be too dangerous." So when they found out what I wanted to do, they said they couldn't take responsibilities for anything as abnormal as trying to change your cholesterol level. Well, I decided then to do it myself.
Despite conventional medical thinking that dietary fats and cholesterol could not affect serum cholesterol levels, Pritikin devised his own diet that was extremely low in fat and put himself on it in 1958.
After a couple of months, I realized that I was no different than any of the animal studies. The same way that animals drop their cholesterol level, so do humans. And I never did run into deficiency on any of the problems at all, and I was just frightened unnecessarily. But it took me a lot of blood tests and a lot of worry before I finish with my experimental work. So it took me a year and a half to bring my cholesterol from 300 down to 160, and another year on the same kind of diet that you're on to bring it from 160 down to 100. And it stayed pretty much from 100 to 120 these last 18 years. Well, now after 2.5 years, this was 1961 already, I finally solved my problem with my blood.
Being an entrepreneur, Pritikin developed the diet that he imposed on himself into a dietary plan that he could sell. He created the Pritikin Diet and the Pritikin Centers, which were an early incarnation of health spas. I asked Dr. David Heber, the founding director of the UCLA Center for Human Nutrition and author of a JAMA patient page on the Pritikin Diet, if he knew Dr. Pritikin.
Oh, I did. I actually knew Nathan very well. Remember the first time I had lunch with him, I had a salmon pate sandwich made with hummus and some type of toast and vegetables. And it was a pretty disturbing meal. But, you know, he was very much into low fat. And fat has several functions. One of the things it does, in addition to enhancing taste, fat also maintains the temperature of food. So by the time the food got to the table, it had cooled off. But this was in the low-fat era. And I have to say, Nathan Pritikin was a really wonderful man. He was a pioneer. He was charismatic. He was an outstanding speaker. And, you know, he actually had both an exercise facility and a kitchen at the Pritikin Center, which was near the beach in Santa Monica. He had a lot of celebrities who went there. He was on the circuit of all the spas that the people who go to spas would go to. And I have to say, he was a really honorable, good person. And the Pritikin diet really was a very healthy diet in a lot of ways, and perhaps a little bit too extreme on the fat. When we did studies on the Women's Health Initiative and other related studies for the National Cancer Institute, we tried to get percent fat in the diet down as an item. And we couldn't really go much below 20% of calories from fat. When you get below that level, it's very hard to maintain it, either in the Women's Health Initiative or Women's Intervention Nutrition Study. So dietary fat, people like fat, they like sweet. And if you get below a certain level, the food becomes less palatable. And taste is really one of the big issues in terms of changing people's diets.
It sounds like it must have been a very difficult diet to stick with, because a lot of taste is associated with the amount of fat in a diet. And as you mentioned, it helps maintain the heat of the food. So you wind up with these like cold things that don't taste very good. So why would anyone want to be on it?
Well, it was a strong health message. I think it was really for health. There was a real sense of community with the spa. And then they commercialized the Pritikin name into different foods, like low salt soups. And now, you know, we've actually reevaluated this whole low-salt issue. And a lot of it is that people need to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables that are high in potassium and low in sodium. And it's really the potassium-sodium balance that's important rather than the absolute amount of salt. So most people eat about 4 grams a day of salt. The recommended level from the Institute of Medicine is 2,300 or 2.3 grams. And for people with illness, 1.5 grams. There's a lot of controversy around that. But low salt was another bad feature of the Pritikin diet. It was very low in salt. So if you got Pritikin soup, it was literally inedible. And they had canned soup that they sold. It was very low salt. So, you know, if you have congestive heart failure, obviously low salt's important. Some forms of hypertension, volume-dependent hypertension, especially in African Americans, salt is important. But for a lot of people, you can tell their salt is excreted in the urine quantitatively, and you can tell how much salt they're eating by looking at urinary sodium levels.
Were there any major clinical trials looking at the Pritikin diet and looking at cardiovascular outcomes that you know of?
I think most of that was done after Nathan's death. When Nathan was alive, most of the studies had to do with metabolism and the metabolic changes. The studies looked at insulin in animal studies as well as human studies. When Dean Ornish came on the scene, he was the first one to really do some controlled studies in relatively small numbers of people. They weren't large clinical trials. And published them in the Journal of the American Medical Association and got a lot of press. And then ultimately, to Dean's credit, he also got Medicare to authorize his diet program, which he has franchised to 6 or 7 hospitals, as an alternative to coronary artery bypass. And the amount of money he's saved is great. There's an emotional component also to the group programs of the Pritikin program. And Dean Ornish has particularly looked at that. He's written a book called Love and Survival, and it has a lot to do with the psychological aspects of group interaction and being able to be part of a community that's sharing this. And so I think the whole low-fat, balanced diet, maybe with some healthy fats, has lived on beyond Pritikin. So he started the ball rolling, but I think today we have in the whole heart health area, there's no question that he made a major contribution carried on through Dean Ornish and other people.
Are people still using the Pritikin diet?
I think the Pritikin diet still is listed as, you know, one of the diets that's pretty popular. It has maintained its name. I think today we've had also a lot of popular writers who called it the big fat lie and that we shouldn't have had all these low-fat diets over the years. And but now there's been kind of a, with the keto diet especially, high levels of olive oil, which is a healthy omega-9 fat to make the food taste better, has solved a lot of the problems that the Pritikin diet had. And other than the calorie impact, the olive oil and avocados are neutral in terms of heart health impact.
If a patient comes to you and asks you, you know, Dr. Heber, I heard about the Pritikin diet. What is it and should I go on it? What do you tell them?
Well, I tell them, look, there's a lot of good things in the Pritikin diet. I think that I haven't lost anybody yet to fatty acid deficiency. You only need about 5 to 10% of your total calories from fat. And the Pritikin diet's somewhere around 10 to 15% fat. In terms of the taste of the diet, you may want to use a little more healthy olive oil, extra virgin olive oil with antioxidants. Maybe spray it on as you barbecue your vegetables and be a little liberal with it. I think I might tell them to be a little careful with the amounts of beans that they're getting because beans are 250 calories. Calories a cup and will promote weight gain if you have too much of it. Half a cup of beans is 125. That's fine. But, you know, I think that moderating the fat and eating colorful fruits and vegetables, because you can have 7 servings a day of fruits and vegetables for only 500 calories. And then making sure you get adequate low-fat protein, whether it's from the plant world like soy protein or whether it's lean meats and fish. A lot of people today are semi-vegetarians. They eat chicken breast and they eat ocean-caught fish, stay away from farmed fish, and they do pretty well with that kind of a balanced diet. And then adding in exercise. So I tell them there's not any magic to it, but it's based on a population studies done all over the world. And a peanut in Vietnam is different than a peanut in Southern California. So, you know, the idea that, you know, people eat handfuls of nuts with a double scotch is very different than a Vietnamese farmer who's throwing peanuts into a big dish full of vegetables and a small amount of sesame oil.
Are there any foods that you absolutely must avoid with a Pritikin diet?
I think Pritikin was pretty much against, you know, red meat and high-fat meats in particular. And I have to say, meats have changed since I was a kid. We used to have something called meat tenderizer, which was a proteinase that would actually tenderize the meat. Today, you don't need to do that because the cattle are selected to be obese and they're finished with a high-fat, high-corn diet. And today, the cattle are obese. So it depends on the cut of meat. It depends on the type of cow. Kobe beef is almost 99% fat with a little bit of meat in between. So, you know, there are lean meats and wild meats that come from game are very low in fat, like venison and things like that. But in general, Pritikin didn't have, you know, steaks on the grill because that was the other culture. You know, at those days, my doctor gave me some statins for heart disease and some high blood pressure. I'm going to the steakhouse tonight to get dinner. That was kind of the attitude at that time. And the 2-martini lunch, and this takes you back to the Rat Pack days and people walking in a silk suit with their first heart attack at age 42, smoking, drinking. Today, many millennials are vegetarian. 18% of the world's population eats a vegetarian diet today. So things are really moving far away from what was the old high-fat 1960s diet to something that's much more close to the Pritikin philosophy, but with a higher level of fat.
So with the Pritikin diet, if you reduce fatty foods like meats, what do you replace them with?
Well, mostly they're replaced with lower fat protein sources like mixing beans and rice, which are complementary. So he would have rice and beans. Now, the calorie level of that might be higher, which is why the Pritikin diet did not always lead to weight loss. And But they did combine exercise with it. So you would replace that with beans and rice or soy products. You definitely would have fish oil capsules as well for the fish oil. You might have ocean-caught fish. And I don't remember him having, it's possible they had turkey breast. He was so focused on the fat that turkey breast is lower in fat than chicken breast. I think chicken breast is like 10% and turkey breast is 5%. So he would have turkey breast, but not chicken breast. So, you know, that's kind of very a fat-focused kind of an approach.
During his lifetime, Pritikin educated physicians about the merits of his dietary program at his seminars.
And now the questions came out just like a torrent. And I realized that physicians, at least this group of physicians, were completely oblivious to the nutritional factors that cause degenerative diseases. They understood vitamins and minerals as far as prescribing. They knew about low salt diets and the American Heart Association diet, American Diabetic Association diet. But they didn't have the slightest idea what the relationship was to disease.
That was in the 1960s. 60 years later, physicians still receive very little training in nutrition, and there's insufficient emphasis in medical training on the relationship between nutrition and disease. To sum it all up, Nathan Pritikin was an entrepreneur who at a reasonably young age was told he had a high cholesterol level and coronary artery disease in an era where there was no treatment for cholesterol, and patients with cardiac disease were told to just avoid exercise for fear that they would die if they stressed their heart. Pritikin came up with the idea of an ultra-low-fat diet, which he developed on his own, administered it to himself, and found that he was able to substantially reduce his cholesterol levels, a notion that countered the prevailing thought in traditional medicine of the day. His diet caught on, and his name lives on, as one of the diets that people still use today. The main problem with the Pritikin diet is that it recommends extremely low levels of dietary fat, as low as 10 to 20% of ingested calories. And that results in a diet that's very unpalatable and hard to maintain. In the modern era, where cholesterol is easily reduced with a variety of available drugs, and coronary lesions can be bypassed with stents or surgery, the Pritikin diet plan, with its extreme reductions in fat and salt, is no longer necessary in its original form. In the modern era, where obesity is a major problem, it's probably more important to limit carbohydrates and find ways to encourage patients to reduce their caloric intake no matter how they do it, irrespective of dietary composition. In the September 3, 2014 issue of JAMA, a network meta-analysis was published examining the effect of various named diets on weight loss. The investigators found that it didn't matter if the diet emphasized low fat or low carbohydrate. What mattered most was that patients found a diet that they could live with that resulted in them eating fewer calories in the long term. That wraps up this episode of JAMA Clinical Reviews. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. David Heber from UCLA, and the McDougall Program for providing audio of Dr. Pritikin. More of that audio can be found at drmcdougall.com. This episode also has CME, and you've already done most of the work towards earning credit for this activity. There's still an article to read and a brief quiz. Links to the article and the quiz are available in the description for this episode. If you want to get all of our Clinical Reviews podcast and CME in the same place, check out JN Listen in the Apple Store. You can find all of our audio at jamanetworkaudio.com, and you can subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode was produced by Daniel Morrow. Our audio team here at JAMA includes Jesse McQuarters, Shelley Steffens, Lisa Harden, and Mike Berkowitz, the Deputy Editor for Electronic Media here at the JAMA Network. I'm Ed Livingston, Deputy Editor for Clinical Reviews and Education for JAMA. Thanks for listening.